You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Mia is here with me, our engineer slash editor. Mia, for those of you who didn't know, is a trans woman, right?
Yeah, I would say most of your listeners probably don't know that. Why would they know?
They would know. So this is the first time we're telling you.
Yeah.
Mia is a trans woman.
Mm-hmm.
She is our engineer. She used to be Tyler.
Yeah, people have probably heard me on the show before.
Today's guest, Rainn Wilson. This guy blew me away. I mean, he stopped me at some point and goes, we're getting deep. You don't want to talk about Dwight or any of that, right? And he's like, I really like this because we just got really deep. I think this was really helpful to me. I hope it's helpful to you.
Yeah, you guys talked a lot about faith and having a rough childhood and a little bit about The Office. It was a really great episode.
I felt that way too. I felt like he just really opened up and he goes, wow. And then he took a deep breath and then he would start talking about his father and his stepmother and things that would happen and the journey along the way. And when he got success, he said, you know, I was a bit of an asshole at some point in my life. I go, wait, what? You? Because you don't get that when you're talking to him, right?
Yeah, he's just not at all like the characters that he plays on screen. He's just so normal and personable and
great
to talk to.
Yeah, he was just a really wonderful interview, and I think you're going to really enjoy getting inside Rainn Wilson.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Somebody made that. Some fan made that.
Oh, I thought that was from Funko.
I wish. That would have meant this podcast is tremendously successful. I mean, it is a success, but tremendous would mean Funko made a Pop doll out of me. Is it a Pop doll? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, they're just doing a Dwight one.
Really? You got a Dwight? I got a Lex Luthor one, but you have a Dwight
one?
Yeah. Oh, you want to bring the mic closer to
you.
Yeah,
okay. You have the craziest guests on here. I mean, most of them make sense, but then you've got like Jeannie Buss. Like, what's up with that? That's so weird.
You know, Jeannie and I became friends years ago, and I don't know anything about basketball, and I didn't ever go to a basketball game, and she was a fan of Smallville, and she came up to me and started talking to me at some event, and I go, oh, cool. She goes, well, if you ever want to come to a game, here's my card. And I go, cool. And then I go, vice president of the Lakers. Now she's the president.
Yeah.
And so I emailed. I said, hey, you know, you said to a game? She goes, you have 4 tickets in valet. I think that was early 2000s. She said after the game, she goes, Michael, I'm serious. I had so much fun with you and your friends. You're so fun. You are welcome to come to any game ever, whenever you want. You just so then slowly became friends. She came to my Halloween bash. She came to like, she brought Kurt Rambis.
That's fantastic.
Rambis was dressed as Kurt Rambis from the 80s with the goggles and stuff.
I always thought how fun it would be for me to dress as Dwight.
Why not?
And people would look and be like, is that the, I can't possibly be the, is that the.
Do you dress up for Halloween?
I did when we went out with my son. My son is 14 now. And yeah, there's several years. We went, one year we went as a vampire family. That was really fun.
Oh, that's
nice. All 3 of us were vampires.
Where do you go? Do you go around the neighborhood trick-or-treating with them?
We've gone all over, you know, all over. We're out in Agoura Hills out in the suburbs, sometimes Calabasas and sometimes Malibu and. Yeah.
You got a really sexy voice.
Thank you.
I'm not hitting on you. I'm just saying when we've met at various places, I was like, I didn't notice the voice as much as I do now, but it's resonating with the microphone. Maybe are you feeling the sexiness through the mic?
I'm getting it a little bit. Yeah.
Isn't that weird when you get around a mic, you just kind
of. It's a little different when you have a mic and then you have the cans on your head, you know, and you hear your voice. So
do you like your own voice?
It's a little late night DJ. I like my voice. Yeah. I actually had a radio show when I was in high school and I was thinking this one of the paths of my life could have gone in is like radio DJ.
Me too. I was a DJ in college. I had a Sunday night shift from 10 to 2 in the morning and no one listened. So I'd say, hey, if you're the 5th caller, you'll get a 6-inch Subway, which I would pay for.
And no, you get 3 calls.
No, I would end up going, if you're the first caller, nobody called. And then I said, okay, that Subway goes out to Jerry Nunn, who coincidentally was my roommate in college. But it was fun. I liked, there was something about being alone, but being with the music and having the choice to play what you want.
Yeah.
Like you're talking to an audience hoping some people are really enjoying it.
Yeah.
And yeah. And it just felt like I thought I might become a DJ. I really considered that, or a sports announcer.
You could still do this.
Could you be a sports announcer? Would you do that? Do you know a lot about sports?
I know a good amount about sports. I know from looking at me and like knowing my life, I know a lot more about sports than you would think that I would know.
Right.
But
right, right.
Mostly NFL, but also a little NBA.
So how would you commentate a game if you had like just a moment or two?
I don't think funny people should do that. Remember that failed Dennis Miller experiment with Dennis Miller on Monday Night Football?
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. It just didn't work.
It did not work
at all. And he's a bright guy. Brilliant guy.
Yep, yep. And but, he loves the game and he's super smart and it just didn't fit.
Well, you know what you want? I think when people listen to a game or they listen to a baseball or a football game, don't you? It's comfort. It's mm-hmm. Here's the pitch on the...
That's right.
It's just something that's relaxing. Now it's honeydew season, folks. Honeydew this and honeydew that. Fans filing in off the subway ramps, a beautiful day for a ball game. And you're just like, oh my gosh, I just want to sit around
right.
and relax.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a baseball thing. NFL is, I like to watch NFL sometimes with the sound off because they just don't shut up. And my wife always talks about that. Like, why don't they ever just stop talking? Like, you don't have to talk every square inch all the time. But it's just this constant, like, oh, that was good. Crowd the bleachers there. You know, another thing, when he was drafted, blah, blah, blah. You know, time and time again, he's proved that. You know what I mean? It's a constant.
It is. But don't you think they're thinking, oh, my gosh, it's 5 seconds since I've spoken. People are going, what's going on? Are they going to the bathroom? What are they doing at this
moment?
They're
going to get bored.
Are they just justifying their jobs? Like, why am I here if I'm not constantly talking?
I think so. I think they feel like, especially Joe Buck got a lot of heat, right? You know,
yeah.
Joe Buck,
yeah,
people,
sure,
a
sure.
lot of hate mails. What was that all about?
I don't know. I didn't follow the Joe Buck controversy.
Yeah, there was a big controversy with him. He was getting so much hate and he was on Stern and he's just got, yeah, those guys, I think some of them like to, I wonder if that's how they talk when they're at home, you know, like,
yeah.
Hey, have you seen Johnny? Johnny's outside and the gardener's just a bit to the right of the home pulling some daisies. I mean, they don't talk like that. They can't talk like that.
I think they have that ability. They have that ability to just stream sentences together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's part of why they're hired. You have that ability. That's why you're a podcast host.
Yeah. You know, that's scary too, because my whole life I've been an actor and, but now you can do things.
You were an actor before you were a podcast host?
Podcast artist. Is that what they're called now?
Podcast artist.
I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I want to be called an artist.
Yeah.
I still love acting and all that, but there's something about this for me that I never thought I'd like. There's just something about it that I feel, I don't know, a connection. I'm able to really listen to people.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I don't listen in my real life, but it forces you to really listen to people.
Right.
And get to know them and see what sort of makes them tick and see how do they... It's just interesting. It's become interesting. At first, I thought it was like, oh, I'm an actor, and hopefully people can listen to my thing, and I'll just make an income out of this. It'll be a supplemental. And then I just sort of go, this is fun to talk to people every day. Mm. They come to your house, and you have some water.
There's a little therapy aspect to it.
You just nailed it, because that's what it is for me. For me, it's therapy. It's kind of like going, hey, if rain's a little effed up, then maybe it's okay for me to be
I'm actually going to therapy after this podcast.
Is that true?
That is absolutely true. My therapist's in the Valley.
Really? Have you been going a while?
I've been going for a long time. Yeah.
I have too. And in fact, I've just started saying this, but I'm going to a treatment center.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not for alcohol, drugs, or sex or anything, but for just, you know, just to get my mind clear. And it's just, I just after all these years.
Where is it? Which, can you say?
It's on the East Coast, the Upper East Coast.
Okay. That would be New England. All right.
That would be around that
area.
Is it
the one that Kit Harington went to that was like $20,000 a day or something like that?
I couldn't afford that, but it could be.
In podcast money? With all the podcast money rolling in?
Yeah. Well, but listen.
But is it like a meditation thing? Or like
I think it's a combination of the world's best psychiatrists and therapists and yoga teachers and chiros and acupuncture. And
I went to a place like that.
Where?
I went to a
Upper
place.
West Coast, was it?
No, I went to, I'll say the name of it because it's really cool. It's called PCS in Scottsdale, and they do all kinds of intensives. It's like you go 12 hours a day, you're in group and you're single, and they have a lot of different people with addictions there. So they have people that are getting alcohol treatment and drug treatment and sex addiction treatment and you know, all kinds of different codependent stuff. But then there's just people that are just digging into issues, you know, and I was kind of in that realm, just kind of digging into some deeper issues. Like you said, like family stuff and just clearing my head stuff and getting to the bottom of of some stuff, and it was really cool.
I'm going to a place called Privé Suisse, and I believe it's probably the place that Kit went to. I don't know.
That sounds fancy.
But it's, you know what it is? It is a couple of friends, people have mentioned it, and they're like, listen, I think you'd truly benefit from it.
Yeah.
And I figure, like, if you're going to invest in a house, or if you're going to invest in material things or certain, you know, if you're going to spend money, why not spend money on your well-being?
Listen, especially if you come from a fucked up family and you didn't gain certain life skills. Like, I didn't learn about how to do interpersonal relationships from my parents, who are terrible at them.
Yeah, so yes, me too.
I've had to kind of like learn myself, and I've got a lot of bad habits and patterns that come from childhood traumas and whatnot. And why not spend like 1 hour a week? Like, what's the big deal? It's 1 hour a week, and you know, $100, $1,100 or something like that. But to improve myself, to learn about myself, to dive deep into my emotions and trauma and background and family and current relationships and relationship to work and career and self-image and my spiritual journey and life journey. So it's an investment that's way more important than going to the gym.
Yes.
But people will always pay the whatever money for trainers and going to the
gym. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
That they won't work out their mind.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I'm fine as long as they look good.
And their hearts and their souls, you know.
I think that's true. I just was listening to an interview with Howard Stern, Anderson Cooper on CNN.
I didn't hear that
one. He interviewed Howard Stern, and Howard Stern started talking about psychotherapy and how it's really saved his life.
Yeah.
And he talks about trauma and like all these things. And it's not that his parents were so horrible. It was more like he always wanted to get approval from his father.
Yeah.
His father worked in radio, and he was just like, oh God, he works in radio. He saw how he reacted to radio hosts, and he was sort of enamored by them. And he goes, wow, if I could do this, maybe he would give me that respect or that approval that I need. And it's something that seems so, like, for a long time, I felt like I can't do this because, you know, people are going to think I'm crazy or I'm this, and I'm an adult now. Get over it, dude. Forgive people. And I go, I do. I forgive my dad. I love my dad. I forgive my mom. She's insane. In my head, I forgive because I know that that's the way to do it. It doesn't solve it. It's like sometimes my mind and my body don't connect. My mind is somewhat fairly on the lower end of sophisticated. We'll say, dude, you're an adult now. This is the right thing to do. You need to do it. But my body reacts in a different way, whether it's fight or flight and the stress levels. And I came to a place where I'm like, I'm too stressed all the time. I wake up with anxiety. I'm worrying about too many things. My head's cloudy. I can't compartmentalize. I can't do all these things. So I'm like, I need somebody to fucking help me. I need right now is the time, because I want to be the best human being and the best, maybe the best actor, the best podcast artist, whatever it is I can be. So why the hell not?
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. This guy that I've been going to now for quite a few years down in the valley, he does this gestalt therapy, which is, I don't know a whole lot about what, I haven't like read books about it or anything, but I know that that's what it's called, what he does. But it's actually really interesting for actors, because what he'll do is, like, if there's some issue, like, let's say there's a part of myself that's really belittling, like, I'm just like, oh, Rain, you fucked that up, and you're such an idiot, and you'll never make it, and you, no one respects you, whatever, like, let's say that voice is coming up, and I'll talk about that in therapy. And he'll say, oh, who is that guy? Sit him down in the chair across from you. Now have a conversation with him, with that person that's in your head. Literally. So I'll say, you know, like, hey, who are you? Why do you beat me up like this? What, you know, I'm doing a piss poor job of him, but, you know, I'll talk to him, and then I'll go sit, and he'll go, no, go be that guy. Go sit in the chair and talk to you. And then I'll go sit in the
chair.
You
mean respond? Respond to what you were just saying.
As that voice in your
head. Oh my God, that seems so.
So then I'll go sit in the chair, and I'll be like, Rain, you little pussy piece of shit. What the fuck are you doing, you loser, you fucking belittle. And he'll just like belittle me, and then I'll go back and I'll switch again, and I'll be Rain, and I'll talk to this guy and be like, you can't talk to me that way, blah, blah, blah. And then after you do that, like 6-8 times switching, and then you kind of like, you feel done or whatever. Sometimes it's emotionally cathartic. Sometimes it's not. Like, you have a much greater understanding of like, who is that voice in your head, and what's my relationship to that voice in your head? So it doesn't own you. That voice doesn't own you. You see it as just a part of yourself.
But what if you're going, what if your response is, you're absolutely right? Everything you just said is exactly right.
Then you got some serious work to do.
What if you're like, yeah, then you're I'm a pussy.
Then you're being victimized by this voice in your head and you're just you're living as a victim. And you've got to do some other kind of work to get at that.
And you feel like this really was cathartic? It was helpful to you?
I've done it. I've done it dozens of times.
And is it weird the first time in front of this person?
It's so weird.
You're like, I can't do this.
It's so self-conscious. You feel like such a... You can also do it by writing, by the way. You can just do it in a journal and you can be yourself and write and then be the character and write. And then you can do that and bring it in.
Can you do it alone? Can I do it like when no one's around except my assistant in the other room? And I'm like, Michael, you're such a fucking idiot. And then, no, you're not.
Why don't we do it right now, Michael? What are you afraid of?
Oh, my God. I don't think I could do it. I don't think I could do
it. It's hard, but here's the deal. You get to a certain point where it's like, I'm so fucking tired of these voices in my head owning me. Like, you'll just do it. You'll just be like, fuck it. I'm just going to fucking do it.
Yeah.
I'm going to look like an idiot. I'm going to feel so self-conscious. You get a greater peace and understanding of yourself on the other side. You're like, okay, this is humiliating and weird and uncomfortable, but I'm just going to do it because I know that what's on the other side is a greater tranquility and wisdom.
Wow. That's profound. And I haven't heard that before, that sort of thing, but maybe that's what I'll be doing at this place. And I feel like, you know, I have a lot of, you know, I've had surgery and stuff and I have this pain and things, and I'm wondering how much could be emotional. Did you ever have any kind of pain? Did you ever deal with any pain?
I haven't dealt with that. No, I'm sorry. Okay. I feel bad. I know you've had these.
Well, thanks for being here.
I've heard you had these surgeries and that you've been through some shit.
Shit, but you know, I'm still able to do like.
You look great, thanks. By the way. You look like you're chipper, you're sharp, you're handsomer than ever. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Switch seats with me now.
You have great teeth, by the way.
By the way, these are knocked out kind of from hockey injuries. So I got these. Well, you know what's funny?
They're falsies. Okay.
Well, just these top ones. But okay. My manager once, Dave Becky, who represented a lot of the big guys.
I know back Dave.
In, you know Dave. Yeah. And this is back in the day when he represented like Mark Maron. I think he still does. But this was early on in New York. Like I was the only actor and there was like five big comedians. And I remember he said to me, because I was on the show, he was like, I had these like fangs because I got punched in the face. And so these two middle ones were in and the fangs were kind of out. He said, I want you to fix your teeth. And I go, what? He's like, I just think you're going to get bigger roles and it will help you. I think you're a character actor right now and you can still do that. But I think if you want some lead roles and you want to be considered as this, I think you should get them fixed. And I got a retainer and it straightened my teeth out.
Yeah.
And I booked a lead part like within like 6 months.
Look at that.
And so that was actually good advice, you know. Yeah. Where I don't even know where that story came from, why I said it. Do you know?
I have no idea.
Oh, because we were talking about my teeth, but that's why.
And that you look good.
And then.
Yeah. I got my teeth. I got my teeth fixed too.
Let me see your smile. They're great. They're good teeth.
And they're okay.
Why? Should have sit in the chair.
But I had, who's that voice?
Who's that voice telling
your teeth are just okay? Rain, your teeth suck.
No, they don't. They're straight. They're almost perfectly white.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
You just said that you lost your dog.
Yeah.
And it was yesterday had to put your dog down. And, you know, I'm sitting here with an 11-year-old dog who I'm starting to think that and feel that. And I'm like, why is he here? Oh, my gosh. How is he able to manage? I would have completely understood if you said, hey, Rosie, I can't do it. Michael, I can't come over. I just lost my dog. Are you? Is it something? Do you like to keep busy so you don't dwell on those things? Is that sort of?
So this is a great topic, and I think it's a really underexplored topic. So our dog was 16 years old, and we had the vets come and put her down in our yard, and we had a ceremony for her. And 16 for a pit bull is like ancient, and everything was falling apart about her. She was incontinent. She would fall down. She was not able to pick herself up. So sometimes we just find her by the water bowl, and we don't know if she was there 10 minutes or an hour. She was on pain meds, had been for the last year. And you come to a certain point of like, well, when is this time? You know, she's just every week she's getting worse. Every time you get a dog, it's an emotional time bomb of, you know, 12 to 15 years. At some point, that bomb is going to go off. And it's like, it's a much larger discussion just about the miracle of life and the cycle of life, and that things come into existence and things that I'm thinking about my own mortality. I'm 53 years old. You know, I am more than halfway through my life. I don't have that kind of standard. It's about mortality and like what the world is about. So, you know, I wept my eyes out. I was there with my wife. We held each other. We cried. We wrote poetry to her. We wrote things. My son wrote a haiku for the dog, and we prayed and kind of meditated with her in the garden and just gave her flank steak from Whole Foods, you know, and just we had a beautiful ceremony. And I guess why I'm here is because I grieved. I was able to cry and really grieve. We knew it had been coming, and it was coming for months in advance, so we were prepared. And also because I believe that things die, and especially animals. And if you go to a farm or just watch a nature show, like right now, Michael, animals are dying all over the planet.
People, animals.
And people.
Everyone
things are
goes.
Just dying, and things are getting born
yeah.
all the fucking time. And it's beautiful, and it's scary, and it's part of the miracle of being alive.
Well, you said something also right before we started filming where you were talking about like people sometimes they want to do everything to keep that animal yeah. alive, and how it's sort of selfish in a way.
It is selfish. They have the dog's on a catheter and has an IV for diabetes, and they're giving radiation treatments, and like I took my dog in for its sixth $5,000 radiation treatment, you know, and it's like guys let it go and take that money and rescue other pets, you know, yeah. or give it to a dog rescue organization, or, you know, instead of spending that $30,000 to keep your dog alive. And it's, if they're in pain and great discomfort, then it's time to let them go. And I just noticed on your shelf that you have the Dummy's Guide to Judaism.
Yeah. And you know, I'm so dumb.
Judaism for Dummies. Have you even read it?
No, that's how dumb I am. I couldn't even read it.
You haven't even read.
Well, look right next to it. Dummies on Religion. I probably read about 20 pages on the shitter, but that was.
And there's a Jew in America too?
You know, inadvertently, I put a Jew in America book right in between the Judaism for Dummies and Religion. For Dummies. I've read a lot of these books, believe it or not, mostly history books.
Yep.
But I don't know a lot about religion. I was just talking about that. I was like, you know, I'd like to learn a little bit more about religion. I have friends, I have close friends who are Mormons, who are Catholic, who are Jewish, who are call themselves atheist or agnostic. And, you know, and that's an interesting topic because you are part of a religion, right?
Yes, I am.
How do you pronounce it?
Baha'i.
Baha'i.
Yeah.
And I read a little bit about it, and it just seems like, I could be wrong because I don't know a lot about it, but it just seems like it's almost everything combined in a way. Yeah, it's sort of like it's a nothing's wrong. No religion is wrong.
That's a good way of looking at it. There's certainly more to it than that. But the Baha'i faith believes in the essential divinity of all of the world's major religions. So that all of these divine teachers have been sent by God to give man a gradually unfolding spiritual lesson plan, whether it's, you know, Krishna or the Buddha or Moses or Abraham or Jesus and Muhammad, that they're all from one God and giving different messages at different points in time around the world. And Baha'is also believe that a new dude came down. His name is Baha'u'llah, which is a title that means the glory of God. and Baha'u'llah came in Persia in the mid-1800s, so Baha'is are also followers of Baha'u'llah. But we also, at Baha'i meetings, we'll read from the Bible, we'll read from the New and Old Testament, from the Quran, from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, and we believe in all of these
religions.
So
it's sort of a culmination of all these things.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, but is it still a monotheistic?
Monotheistic, yeah. Right. One God and this God. And it's, you know, and, you know, God gets a bad name. I actually have been pitching a TV show that I think has just been turned down everywhere around town called The Notorious G.O.D., where I want to kind of do my own exploration of, like, what God is. It's like, okay, because everyone's like, oh, I don't believe in God. But then if you talk to them, they're like, they definitely believe in something more than just physical molecules. They just don't believe in an old white guy on a beard who's really judgmental, scowling down and shooting lightning bolts and, you right, know, right. That kind of God. So in the modern world, we need a new definition or a new understanding of what divinity is and what sacred is and what spiritual is and what the soul is. You know, it's, we have to reject these kind of these old, really limited kind of tropes around those ideas.
Yeah, what I do not like is when people say, well, I'm going to, you know, I follow Jesus and I do all these things because I want to go to heaven.
Right.
Instead of, you know, oh, so you don't want to do, you want to do it just because you want to go to heaven. That's why you believe in this. As opposed to
right.
sort of having an understanding and a feeling of faith. Or, hey, we're all created by something. Like this microphone is, somebody created that, you know? And I believe in all evolution, obviously, and the Big Bang Theory.
A guy named Keith in Dayton, Ohio created this microphone.
There you go. Something can't come from nothing. I don't know.
So I went through an atheist phase when I grew up Baha'i and I rejected it for a long time and was in a, just doing my own thing in New York City and was in an atheist phase. But then at the end of the day, like when I would really deeply think about being an atheist, like, okay, so 14 billion years ago, there was a speck and that speck exploded and made all energy, matter, and molecules. And then solar systems and galaxies were created. And then
single cell organisms.
And then all of this stuff was created, but there's no purpose or meaning or anything behind it. Shit happens. And then I think about myself, like I'm just an animal, just like dear sweet Una, who we put down the other day, and I'm just having my experience, and then I'm going to die and my consciousness will just disappear forever. And it doesn't make any sense to me at the end of the day for me, that worldview, that universe view. And there are people who absolutely it makes sense to them. But sure. For me, it doesn't. My life experience of going through the world is emotional and spiritual and physical and psychological. And, you know, I feel connectivity and I listen and I have experiences and I gain wisdom. And mine isn't just kind of like, oh, I'm this kind of bio robot in this purposeless
right.
universe.
And there's something nice about looking at something and going, somebody created, that's faith right there. That's that. Come on.
Yeah.
What's that right there?
That sunset.
That's just so beautiful. And then people will argue the whole thing. Well, there's a lot of reasons why people do. And I have friends who are atheists and they'll just say, I just don't believe. I don't believe this. I go, it's nice to think that there is something bigger than all of us.
Well, not to mention that I believe that.
And remember, I haven't read
The Idiot's Guide to Judaism.
I haven't read. So I don't know what I'm talking about. It's just a feeling.
All right. But if I made the show The Notorious G.O.D., you'd right. watch it, though.
Damn right I would.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Event television.
Because you'd explore
like
those.
Game of Thrones. You would turn it on when it was on the TV.
So if someone dies, everyone's expendable?
I don't know what that means.
I mean, in the Game of Thrones, every character dies.
Oh, that's true. Much. Yeah.
Did you watch Game of Thrones?
Oh, of course.
Did you love it?
Loved it, yeah.
I loved it. I'm not one of those cynics that are like, you know, I didn't dissect it like everyone else did. I just felt like this is a major motion picture every week, and I'm really enjoying it. Until the final episode, I was like, boy, what just happened?
Yeah.
That's how I think a lot of people feel like that. And I'm not that critical. Like, I'll say Breaking Bad. Oh, I love the ending. What a great ending.
I had some issues with the last season.
It was rushed. It felt rushed.
It felt rushed. It just feels like, because I think the showrunners were kind of like, we want to get on to our next gig.
Yeah.
How can we tie this up? I mean, they defeated the Night King in one episode. Like, that took one episode. Like, let's have a big battle and then he'll get stabbed and then we're done. Okay. Let's on to Cersei.
And then Jon Snow just kills Daenerys like that, and the dragon flies off to fucks off to nowhere. Yeah. And then Arya's like, I'm going to go head out to the Western, whatever the hell I'm going. And then this dude that I've never seen is standing up talking. And
that was one of the amazing things about some of the early mid-seasons is like, stuff was slow, and it took a long time.
Yeah. What about the faceless... Arya with that. What happened with that?
Yeah.
It never, you thought she was going to come back and end up killing someone, pretending she's someone else. What was that season for then?
That was my pitch for Game of Thrones, is that one of the White Walkers is there and kind of walks forward and is nodding his grizzled, weird head. And then all of a sudden pulls off and it's Arya and stabs the Night King because she's like,
beautiful.
You know, that would have been a little better. But yeah, it was just rushed. There were some great moments in it. There were some beautiful images, but it was a little rushed.
Yeah. You had a pretty good childhood or no? At 3 to 5 years old, you already had a stepmom. Your parents were already divorced at a young age, right?
My mom took off when I was about 2.5 years old. So
what do you mean took off? Like, well, was gone?
It's a weird story. Are you up for a weird story?
I'm always up for a weird story.
So she left. Me and I went with my dad, and I never knew why they got a divorce. And I didn't really see her again until I was about 15. And once or twice she came by and visited. But I would always say to my dad, like, why did you guys get a divorce? And my dad was all, he's very kind of airy-fairy. And he's kind of like, well, I don't know. We just went our separate ways, I guess. I was like, what does that mean? Like, there's no grit there. There's no specifics. What the fuck? And when I started acting in high school, my dad was always weird about it. He was always very supportive of me being an artist of some kind. But when I started acting, he was just, you could just tell he wasn't completely all in to me being an actor. So, and I was like, what the hell's going on? So then I talked to my mom and she said, you mean your dad never told you? And I was like, no, he never said. And she said, well, I was an actress in Seattle in the late 60s and I was doing a play. And I had an affair with the theater director, and I left your dad for the theater director. So a lot of weird things kind of come together from that story, like, A, why I'm an actor. I didn't even know that she had been an actress, and I was drawn to acting. So there's obviously some kind of genetic component there. Do you have a parent that was an actor or something like that?
My mom did repertory theater.
Okay,
because But my dad definitely... did not want me to do that. I was the antithesis of him, and I could tell he didn't like it. I wasn't, you know, book smart. I didn't get high score in SATs. I wasn't like so cerebral, and I just felt that I just was not the kind of son he wanted. That's how I felt.
Yeah.
Completely. And of course, he's looking at me with, of course, disdain for my mother, because they eventually, you know, when she sort of emasculated him, because she was always flirting with other men and probably having affairs, perhaps, that she denies, vehemently denies. But my father, I think, then looked at that like, oh, now I have a son who's a little bit like his mother when it comes to sort of, she's ostentatious. I wasn't ostentatious, but I was very extroverted and weird and all over the place. And he was reserved. And it was like, God, how the fuck did I do this? I go, well, I'll tell you, it starts out with all the acid and the drugs you used back in the 60s. I don't know why I just channeled Chris Farley, but I do that occasionally. I think he was looking at me. I remember after I did a play once in high school, and I told this story, but he, you know, we were at Denny's and I was like, I'm going to be an actor. He's like, eat your steak. And it was just like, you know, he just, you know, I remember going, hey, I'm doing this independent movie, so it's not a real movie.
Oh,
what do you mean? Well, it's an independent movie. Who's in it? Well, there's up and comers. I'm doing a movie. I'm doing the short film. Why is it short? A real movie's long. You know, it was like, Dad, I scored 3 goals in the hockey game. And it was a weak goalie. I mean, there were all these things but my dad was reserved. He was quiet. He had... You know, he took on my mom with 2 kids from her first marriage when he was 18. I do forgive. I do. But back to the actress thing. So I think there's some similarities where I didn't realize it was like, oh, he's an actor. He must have been an actor like his mother, who's all over. Maybe there was this slight comparison. I don't know. But did she have an affair with the...
Yeah, she had an affair with the theater director and then took off with him. And then my dad was heartbroken and he had me, this big, ungainly infant.
But he didn't tell you about it.
He never told me my entire life, which I have a lot of respect for, because you always hear about people getting divorces and just like bad mouthing each other constantly. Like, your mom's a blah, 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 whore, and your dad's an asshole, blah, blah, blah. And he always used to do this. And you always hear this, the kids getting put in the middle and just hearing the worst about their parents. He never said a bad word about her. Never.
Never one.
Nope.
See, that's all I've dealt with my whole life is, your father's a piece of shit and I did this. And then you're, oh, your crazy mother. And you're the, and sometimes in the past, like, you'd almost let them go and side for a second on both sides. And you're like, what am I doing? This is unhealthy. So now I have a thing where I'm like, you know what, Dad? Can't talk about mom. Mom, you can't talk about
that. That's good. Good for you.
You just can't do that. You can't. Also, mom, you can't talk about your daughter who doesn't talk to you anymore. You can't talk about your son who doesn't talk to you anymore. You can't talk about all these people that I do talk to. And I, you know, and you know.
Is that hard to keep that boundary?
It's hard. And it's also draining. And, you know, she's like a child. She, you know, I think. I'm sure I have a rest of development.
Why don't you have her on this podcast?
Because it would be, you know why? Do you know why? She just came here and I thought about that. And I thought, I'm not willing to do that yet. I'm not at the point where I'm vulnerable. I can be vulnerable. I want to surrender. I want to go to this place and surrender all my fears, all my things, and just like fucking, I'm malleable. Just fucking help me and I'm ready to change. But I got to tell you something. This is something that's, I don't know if you dealt with, but it sounds like you didn't. But my mother and my father, I love them. If something happened, I'd feel horrible. But I don't trust them. I don't believe when they're telling me something, immediately my brother and I look at each other like, that might have been 50% true. Like, it's right. Almost like everything is just not only exaggerated.
Yeah.
I swear to God, I asked them both, how did you meet? Something that should have been just easy for them.
Sure. Slam dunk answer.
Completely other sides of the spectrum stories.
Wow.
One, your father asked me for my number from the car when we're driving down the Long Island Expressway, and I yelled it, and he remembered it, and he called me. And the other one is, she forced me to get her number. I took it, and I threw it away. I threw it out the window. And then I remember driving to a gas station, and we're there later that night at 2 in the morning with my friends, and who strolls in? Your mother pulls in. She's like, hey, you still have my number? She's like, he's like, no. So she wrote it on my hand. She wrote it, carved it in my hand. And that night I went to bed and I woke up and I showered and I tried to scrub off the number.
God.
I tried and it wouldn't come off. The number wouldn't come. So I waited and I finally said, you know what? I'll fucking call her. Rain, I'm on everything I own. These are the two stories that they come up
with.
And I'm like,
amazing.
Amazing, but it's like, God damn it. You can't even be honest about how you fucking met.
The unreliable narrator. Yeah.
So, but they didn't lie to you, your parents. They were always pretty honest with you, except for telling you about your mom had an affair, but maybe he was trying to protect you.
How deep are we going to go here? And
listen, this is what I do, man. This is, if you're willing, like some people come and like, I don't want to talk about that. I remember I had one guest where they gave me the little cut the throat thing. Like, don't talk about that.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, so anyway, and I jump to something else, or they call me back and say, hey, could you edit that? And I'm like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You know,
well, it's tough because my parents are all alive and, you know, my dad and my stepmom who kind of raised me and my natural mother. And I don't think they're going to be listening to this, but you know,
thank you. Thanks for that.
But you know, and I wrote a book called The Bassoon King, like this memoir. And I've talked a little bit about it in there. And
because you played the bassoon and clarinet.
And saxophone.
And everything in high school.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a play on that, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot. It's in a lot of ways, I had a really ideal childhood. You know, when it boils down to is this, like, so my dad and my stepmom, she would make dinner. My dad was at work. He would come home from work. We would eat dinner together. We would talk about the day. We would watch MASH on television.
Amazing.
And, you know, and I would goof around and make them laugh. And then, you know, they would buy me new school clothes for September. And then I would go to bed and it was like really normal. And we lived in a house in suburban Seattle and it was like normal. But really, when I look back on it, there was no love in that house. They didn't love each other. They stayed married kind of for me, my dad and my stepmom. I asked them both when I was writing the book, I said, when did you know that you didn't love each other and that the marriage was a mistake? And they were all like, oh, within a year of when we were married in 1969.
And you were born in 66.
Yeah. Right. So I was like, and then they got divorced in 84. Like the second I went away to college, they got divorced. And I literally was like, okay, bye mom. Bye dad. Going to college. See you, son. See you later. Then like by Thanksgiving, they were divorced. So they just literally stayed together for some semblance of thinking that this would be good for me to grow up in a fucking loveless household, you know, in a just a house devoid of love and affection and hugs and laughter. And that will fuck you up in some ways worse than getting like hit. Because if you get like beaten by a bad adult person, they're the villain and they're the bad person, and it's really clear. But when you grow up kind of in this like loveless petri dish of the suburbs, it's you get warped in weird ways, and you don't understand like what
that is so profound. That is so profound, especially for me, because that's what they always said. My dad would go, I go, well, then why would you stay in the marriage? Why did you do that? For you kids.
Fuck you. I didn't want that.
It was such a passive aggressive relationship. Like I look back and I'm like, my mother was like, Mark, how do I look? You look great. And it just goes right through. It's not sustained. It's like, am I pretty? Am I smart? How's my writing? Am I great? And my dad became, oh yeah. He went from, I love you, you're beautiful, to, oh yeah, you're so great, Julie. Everybody loves you. Oh yeah, you're such a great writer. Oh yeah. And then all of a sudden the kids, we'd almost join in like, oh yeah, she's a, and it was almost this fucked up dysfunctional.
Wow.
And they would always talk about the other families in the neighborhood and like, oh, the Cutters, they're fucked up. And she's having an affair with Mr. Hoffman across the way.
Yeah.
And so and so. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, my parents are so smart. And then one day I go, where are the fucked up ones? We're the most fucked up.
Yeah.
We are the most dysfunctional. And again, this is not me talking shit. This is just the reality that I lived in. And I think they both are aware of it. And I think, you know, I look back and I go, Dad tried. He did try hard. He worked his ass off. I think my mother has arrested development. I don't think she went past 16 years old mentality. To this day, at 71 years old, my assistant Jess goes, oh my God, Michael. I go, what? She goes, I know what you're going through. I go, what do you mean you know what I'm going through? I talked to your mother. It's like she's still a 16-year-old girl.
Wow.
And it's fucked. So yeah, go ahead.
That's really great. So many bells are going off as you're talking. Like, first of all, for my wife and I, because we both come from pretty fucked up family situations, we always call it like the love sieve. It's funny that you use a colander, because her and I, like, you know, I can say every day, I love you. You're so beautiful. You're the light of my life. I love you. And the next day she's like, I don't even think you love me. It's like, wait, I just told you 8 days in a row that I did. And she goes, I know. And we joke about it. And I'll do the same thing, by the way. And we'll joke about it that we're this love sieve. Like, we give love, but it just drains right out. You know what I mean? So because we're so flawed that we have to just, it has to be a daily practice of giving love before it's believed. That's one thing. The other thing is
that something you could work on? Do you work on that? Or is it something that's just party that you're just like, I know that's how she is. That's how I am.
I think it can get better, but I don't think it can 100% heal. I think it can get better. You know, you can get better at, you know, developing trust and like, oh, I am loved and I do love, and you know, that's there. But what's interesting is like going back to PCS, that place that I went in for a week-long therapy retreat thing, I had brought my parents in to do some work with them, and they were willing to come in. God bless them. They came in their early 70s to do some therapy with me. They weren't there the whole week, but they did some therapy. One of the things I remember growing up was like my stepmom had a rage problem. So she would sometimes like just blow her stack over something tiny, like literally like I left a dirty sponge in the sink. I remember one time like it had grease on it or something like that. And she lost, and she would like break dishes in the sink and storm off and slam the door and just be like, scream and this big tantrum. And I was, you know, 9 or 10. I'm looking around like, what do I do here with this information? And I feel so strange. And my dad would go, oh, what a beautiful day it is. Look at that bird on that branch. Isn't that tree beautiful? And so I was like 9 or 10 going like, what the fuck
is going on here?
Did you not, how can you do it? And I asked him when I was in the therapy room with him, I was like, Dad, do you remember this happening? And he goes, oh my God. My dad, he's a good guy. He's a good-hearted dude. But he has like the worst childhood of all time. Like he suffered so much, and his mom died when he was a little kid in a tuberculosis farm, and his dad was a total drunk and would take off and leave him with the neighbors. And like he was beaten by a really mean stepmom, and they were, he would get like almost starving. They had like go beg to the neighbors for food. I mean, it was really, really bad. And he goes, when I was a kid and things would get really, really bad emotionally, I would look out the window and I would find something really beautiful.
What?
And I would comment on it to myself. I would
Who would tell him to do that?
He just did it as a defense mechanism for himself, as a survival instinct to kind of look for something good. Like, oh, isn't that tree beautiful? Or isn't it a beautiful day? Or isn't the sky beautiful?
Oh, my God.
And so he had this revelation. He's like, oh, my God, that's what I did when I was a kid. And I was like, well, you did that same thing whenever Kristen was having a meltdown. And I said, that was so fucked up for me, because what I needed you to say is like, hey, your mom is really, really angry right now. How are you feeling? How are you taking that in? I'm going to go speak to her about this. And that's not an appropriate way to use anger. And let's all have a family meeting and talk about anger. And what are productive ways to be angry that aren't destructive? And, you know, that's what I needed. Parenting, you know, yeah. Parenting.
So do you feel like, you know, even though you say your father's a good guy, which he sounds like a great guy, do you think inadvertently there was resentment? Like,
sure.
Why didn't you fucking help me? Why didn't you something? My parents won't listen to this. I told my father not to listen to my show.
Yeah.
I just said, listen, you know, you don't need to listen to it. I'm very honest and very open.
Yeah.
And the reality is I don't want to, you know, embarrass him. And I don't think like I really believe lately he turned over a new leaf. I really feel like, you know, he suffered. He had a daughter who was born with a chromosomal defect in his last marriage. Mm-hmm. And she's almost died 100 times. She will, the oldest, she has a thing called trisomy 13, I believe, where I even got her name tattooed on my arm for him to say, hey, look, I'm here. I love you. Just something. But like, he's been through a lot, and his daughter still lives in a children's hospital. She can't survive without it. And the oldest living survivor with someone with this disease is 20 or 19. So, and she can't talk, she can't walk, she can't, you know, and it's
heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. And she's 14 years old.
Yeah.
And so I know he's been through a lot, but, I always
let's fuck him up.
Let's fuck him up, man. But I think, you know, the thing is like, it's just because you suffered, like I feel so sorry for that, but that should make me go, oh, you know what? Everything you did, everything that happened, it's fine. It's all, I'm good. And I do forgive. I just have to work that shit out because.
Well, here's the thing, because you brought this up before, like intellectually, I forgive my parents. In my heart, I love my parents.
Yep.
That doesn't mean that I have completely processed all of the fears, resentments, and trauma and issues. Because I think that those things are in your body and they need to get processed and they need to get worked out.
Yeah.
So I love my dad. I call him every week. We have really nice talks. He's an artist. He's a sensitive and a kind man. And at the same time, in some ways, he was the world's best father. He was always there for me. He came to my games. He would come to my plays.
Yeah,
you know, he was loving. He was solid. He paid the rent. And in some ways, he was the worst dad. And he was checked out. And he didn't really hug me. And he was not emotionally available. And we never really completely like bonded. But as I understand his trauma of his childhood, I totally get where he was coming from.
Yeah.
You know, so
and everything you said makes, again, wow, you're just ringing bells here today, dude. Just like alarms are going off.
I'm so glad we're talking about this and not like, what was it like playing Dwight?
We really haven't even gotten to that.
Yeah, that's coming next, right?
Oh, yeah, that's coming. No, this is just, to me, this is more interesting. This is like Rainn Wilson's extremely successful and he's had a great career and he's happily married and he has pigs and dogs and all these things. But you know what? He's gone through some shit too, just like you. He's not like perfect and, you know, he didn't. And I think that's like sort of breaking those walls down where people who are listening and dealing with anything can kind of go, oh, wow. And it could help them in any kind of way. And that's what's most important to me. And that to me provides, you know, gives me purpose.
Yeah. And that's a great service.
You know, and look, the things you were saying is like, I remember my dad coached my hockey team and I remember my dad, you know, came to games and there were those things, but there were also those other things that, you know, no one's perfect, but I never got the, I love you. I'm proud of you. You're smart. It was always the converse. It was always, you know, it's like, how could you not understand this? And I don't think he even
but
knew.
Isn't this, I know it's kind of a cliche, but isn't it like that's why you became successful in a weird way?
It is.
Like if maybe.
Absolutely.
If your dad had said, Michael, I'm so proud of you, that you'd be a junior high Spanish teacher, you know,
in Dix Hills,
Long Island. You know what I mean? Nothing wrong with Spanish teachers from Dix Hills, Long Island, but that might be your life as opposed to you really pushed yourself and have driven yourself to, you know, be an actor and produce and write and do comedy. And
absolutely. I wanted to get out. I wanted to prove myself. I always wanted to prove myself. I don't mind that. And again, I know in my mind, this is like, I'm successful. I did all these things, but I still have this tormenting, these feelings that I just need to fuck. So, that's why I'm going. Look, I'm thankful. I'm grateful every day. I'm like, dude, you got a nice house. You got great friends. You have people who care about you. You have two beautiful dogs. You got Rain came over today. I'm grateful for you being here. Mia's here. Mia is awesome. She just came out as a trans woman, right, Mia?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and
congratulations.
She felt
Mia.
Like she could confide in me, and we hugged yesterday. And
oh, that's great. This is recent.
Yeah, just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, this is very recent.
Oh, great.
And I just felt like, you know, like I am grateful for the things in my life. I am just trying to be a better me and feel better. I just want to like acknowledge these things happened and able to. I think what it mostly is managing stress. I am so hard on myself. And I think that worked like as a child. It worked as in college. You can deal with the fatigue. You can deal with all these things because you're young. But again, and you know who said this to me? This is Dolph Lundgren was here. it's getting weirder.
That's the weirdest Hollywood transition. You know who gave me these life-changing words of wisdom?
Dolph Lundgren. If he dies, he dies. But you know what he said to me? He says, you know, when you're younger, you can deal with it. And then when you get older, that same shit that you've been doing, it doesn't fly. You can't handle stress like that. You've got to change your ways.
Yeah.
Old habits must be broken. Must be broken. Mm-hmm. But he's really brilliant. He's a chemical engineer. He was a chemical engineer.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how lucky you get little morsels from each person you talk to.
Yeah.
And I understand that. It's like, you know what? Let's break the habits. Let's break the things. Let's get more structure in your life. Let's think positively.
Yeah.
Let's forget about all this stuff. Let's if you fail, you fail. It's okay to fail. I can't be perfect. Are you still extremely hard on yourself, even when you're doing The Office?
Yeah.
Did you like going, I have to step it up or a hit show? I have to be funny. I have to be this. Were you hard after the show?
Yeah. You know, I've gotten so much better in the last 4 or 5 years. Like I've really made big strides in a lot of ways. I used to be really career obsessed. And you know what that's like in this world of just constant comparing myself to others and like, why is he in that movie and I'm not? And I was, when I was on The Office, like it was all about like, how do I leverage Dwight to get more movie roles and to get greater stardom? And so it was really just hard on myself and really kind of had OCD about that, you know, filming that in my head and going over it again. And now I really let that go.
How?
Well, a lot of it's been this therapy work, you know, and, you know, just work with my wife. She's been really supportive about it. And, you know, as I've kind of loved myself more, I think going more into spirituality has allowed me to love myself more so that I am not my job. I am not my success. My self-esteem is not, it's certainly linked to success and in my work, but I am not my work. I am not how successful my work is going. So I don't need that anymore, but it used to be that way. And it kind of made me an asshole, you know?
You were an asshole.
I don't think if you talk to the Office cast, they would be like, oh, Rain was an asshole. I think we all get along and good, but I could be an asshole. Yeah. I could be pretty narcissistic and self-centered. And yeah, I had some rough years in there.
I mean, were you aware of it? Where you were like, did you go home and say, God, what? I'm an asshole. Like or was that not apparent?
It wasn't apparent to me. It was apparent to my wife.
She's like, you're an asshole, Ryan.
She's like,
would she say that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But she really helped keep me grounded too. So.
You don't seem like someone, and I think I've gone through phases where people, you know, I might've been difficult at one point in my life for a little while or something, or, you know, people thought I had an ego, which I think we all do, but was there any moments on set? Were there any moments where you're just
no,
like,
no, I wasn't
any
that.
Christian Bale moments.
I wasn't that kind of an asshole. I wasn't having like tantrums on set and being really difficult. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find people who say, "Oh, I worked with Rainn Wilson and he was a dick." Because I'm such a people pleaser, so I always want people to like me. You know,
how do we get rid of that? That's a problem.
You put that guy in the chair who's the people pleaser. Have that conversation with your inner people pleaser. What does he need? You know, how do you not get victimized by that voice in your head?
Yeah.
You know, anytime you go to the ego and the self and you become obsessed with ego and self, like, you're just not that pleasant to be around. And there was definitely several years in there, you know, some rough patches in our marriage and stuff like that, where I was not a fun guy to be married to because I was only thinking about myself.
But you stuck with it. And she stuck with you, more importantly.
We stuck with it. We've worked hard. We've done therapy. We've been through a lot.
It's amazing. I'd love to get to that place where my work isn't me at all.
But I don't think it'll ever be at all. I just think it won't have such a hold on you. Do you know what I mean? Like, I always, like, if I get cast in some movie or something, like, I get a boost in self-esteem, and there's something natural about that. You feel good when you're working and you're desired and people want to collaborate with you, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that needs to just be at a right-sized level, Michael.
Right. Like, I'm going to go to work. I'm going to do my job the best that I can. I'm going to have fun on set, be pleasant. And then when I come home, I'm going to be Rainn. It's time for me time. It's not work time anymore.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Separating that's probably not easy.
Yeah, but I've gotten better. So it's been really nice.
So there's hope. Would you say you've had a midlife crisis at all? Like, at some point, did you have that? Like maybe that's what I'm having. maybe.
Is that what you're in?
I don't know. I don't know, but something happened in the last 2 years where I'm just different, but my eyes are opening and I'm starting to reevaluate old habits and mm-hmm. ways and things and going, I can't maintain this for 30 more years. I need to make some changes. I don't like me a lot of times. Mm. I don't, even though I really feel like I'm a good person, and people go, what are you talking about? I am charitable. I am, you know, I do think of others, but I just, there's a lot of things that I just go, you have got to stop worrying about that. You've got to stop obsessing. You cannot always be on and great and please everyone all the time.
Yeah.
You just can't. I cannot maintain it. It wasn't like I go, I'm going to do this. This was like my body going, go to the East Coast. Go to this place.
You have to go.
You have no choice. You're going. Mm-hmm. Here you are. We're white. Oh my God, your fingers are typing. Oh my God, this is kayak.com. Now
you've got plane tickets.
I got plane tickets and I'm going. And my friends are
like, what's your podcast going to be like after you go to this place? You're going to be like so zen.
I don't know. Who knows what I'll be like? But, you know, I think, you know, what the hardest thing is, I sent an email to close friends saying, hey, I'm going to be fine. I'm great. I'm not a drug addict. I'm not an alcoholic, as far as I know. I'm going to this place to clear my head. I'm going to this place to be a better me, to be a better friend, to be a better, and I, not that I'm a bad friend, I think I'm a great friend, but just to be a better all around. What's weird is some people were so shocked. My father, I actually emailed, I just told him, I just was brief about it. He goes, wow, this is a surprise. Good luck. That's it. And we haven't talked about it since. And my friend, one of my good buddies, Harlan.
I'm surprised your dad didn't go like, oh, you couldn't afford the Meadows?
No. I think he's you know what's weird? Is he's so like old school strong and this, and I don't need therapy and I don't need this. That's why when you say your dad got into therapy and your mom got into therapy, I could be the only person in the world that because that's how I feel, Rainn. There's no fucking way that those two would go into real therapy. There's no way my father would be open and vulnerable and loving and crying and fuck off. That would never happen. The fact that you can do that with your parents, and I hear it all the time, is, oh, my dad went with me to this. My dad and I did LSD together. My dad, never! That will never happen.
I think, like, a lot of what you're talking about, Michael, I truly believe that some of the answers to what you might be looking for are spiritual. And I'm not trying to get all new agey, and I'm not trying to convert you to any religion, but just like, do you do meditation?
I was, and then I sort of stopped.
Yeah. Because I've found meditation to be profoundly helpful in so many ways.
Guided or just by yourself, you know, your own
either,
thoughts?
Either. You know, anything. TM, whatever works for you. There's great apps and guided meditations. You can just be still. You can walk in nature and meditate. Whatever it is that to slow the mind, to realize that we're not our minds, that we're not our thoughts, we're not our judgments. That isn't the reality of who we are. That if you read spiritual writings, it always guides you, no matter what, you're Christian or Jewish or whatever, Buddhist, Baha'i, whatever, that we are souls, you know, living in our bodies for a brief period of time, and our souls are growing and developing. This shifts our perspective. And like, oh, I'm a soul, you know, I'm a, you know, as Père Teilhard de Chardin, it's a tough name to get, says, I'm not a human being having a spiritual experience. I am a spiritual being having a human experience. So I love that. Like, I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. Anything I can read, I read Buddhist writings, or I subscribe to this guy, Jeff Kober Meditation. He does these daily emails. He's great.
You do this every teacher. Day?
I won't say every day, but 5 days a week, at least, sometimes twice a day.
So like, give me like a sort of an idea of like what you'll do on these 5 days or certain days. Do you like, you wake up, immediately meditate before you do anything?
No, I'm not that disciplined. It depends. A lot of times I drive my kid to school. So if I drive Walter to school and I kiss my wife and we have some coffee and we check in, maybe we'll even walk the dog. Then I'll go to my office and I will sit down in my orange chair and I have some prayer beads and I do some meditation and I'll set a timer for 15 minutes and I'll do some prayer and meditation and just be really, really still. Sometimes I'll do some journaling work and then I'm like a new man after that. But I always say like, I need that to get to normal because I'm like spun out like this,
yeah,
like kind of the
same
way
you
are.
Yeah.
But meditation, exercise also helps a lot, but meditation and prayer and this kind of spiritual work, reading spiritual writings, brings me to a kind of a level of normalcy of, now I can kind of function. So then I get to just be like a regular person. So I kind of need it.
I could see how happy you get when you, just by talking about this, you just had this, I don't know whether it's spiritual or whatever. You just, there was a glow to you talking about it. Like I do this and I become, and you just had the smile on your face. Like you were almost lost and like, yeah, this is what helps.
But I think there's tools there. You know, I think there's tools. We live in an age right now where spirituality is, well, first of all, because a lot of it is spirituality. What does that mean? Does that mean ghosts? You know, does that mean a yoga class? Does that mean crystals? Does that mean going to church? Does that mean we're in such a bifurcated society of like born agains on one side of the aisle and like secular city people on the other and neither trust each other? And, you know, what does that mean? You know, red state, blue state, you know, what does spirituality mean? But just looking through the world's religions and belief systems, there are tools that help make your life richer, deeper, more meaningful, and allow you greater focus and creativity and allow more kind of love and purpose understanding in your life. So there's like a toolkit. It's literally like, you know, a pliers and a wrench and this and that. And these are some of those tools.
This has been tremendous for me. I hope for you.
What was it like playing Dwight? I'll tell you.
No.
You know, no.
I mean, people know you've done these a million times. You've how many times can you talk about Dwight? I mean, look, you won 3 Emmys, didn't you?
I got nominated. You asshole.
Oh yeah, you. I
got nominated.
Hey, I've never been nominated for an Emmy. I think yeah. I won. I think I won a Saturn Award, a Uranus Award.
Okay.
No, but I was. Hey, it was great. I posed with Steven Spielberg at the time.
Hey.
We both held our award up. And I go, hey, if this is good enough for Steven Spielberg.
It's good enough for you.
It's good
there
enough
you go.
For me. I mean, good. Look.
No, I'm kidding about the Dwight thing. What were you going to ask? You were going to ask something profound.
No, I mean, definitely wasn't going to be profound. But like having like
the spiritual toolkit.
Look, you became an actor, something your father was like, I don't want you to really kind of, you're doing that. Then you figured out why when you were like 19, your mom told you she had an affair with a theater guy. So then you became an actor and then you had huge success.
Late in my career.
How old were you when you had the big success?
I was almost 40 by the time The Office was on.
Yeah, because you had done like things like One Life to Live.
Yeah.
You had done like
Charmed, CSI.
And
yeah.
So you weren't rich at all.
No, not
you had no money.
Not at all. A few, I would say a few months.
I thought you were going to say a few dollars.
A few
dollars.
Maybe a year before The Office, my wife and I were paying the rent using little checks that came in our credit card statement where you could write a check and it would go onto your credit card.
I've done that, yeah.
Yeah. So
I used to pay my credit card bill with my credit card. I had to pay 100 and I would take 100 and I'd send them a check.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Those are the days.
I remember the pitiful look of my landlord. Like he was Austrian. His name was Boris. He's like, do you really want to do this, Rain? He would look at the check from like Citibank credit card and it would be like $1,400 rent. He's like, really? It's a bad idea.
He cared about you.
Yeah.
He liked you. Did you ever go say hi to him?
He ended up being an asshole. So
he did.
Yeah, sorry.
Boris.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Boris.
Are you
Austrian.
Sure you want to pay rent with this?
Yeah.
This is your pay. You're not. This isn't healthy.
No, because then he basically evicted us with no notice because him and his girlfriend broke up and the girlfriend wanted to move into the house. And he was like, you've got to be out in 6 weeks. It's like, what? And then we found out from the city, oh, if he's evicting you in order to put a co-owner into the place, they owe you a fee. So I went to Boris and I was like, you have to pay me $2,000 or $3,000 or whatever because you and your girlfriend Linda both own the properties. And so, and because that, then you have to pay me a relocation fee. And he was furious and he had meetings with us like trying to get out of it. And I was like, dude, it's just the law. It's just the law.
So he paid you.
He had to. It was the law.
It was the law. So 40 years old. That's amazing because.
Yeah, it was I think 38 when the office was on. Maybe 37 when I was shooting.
And they probably
it.
Paid you as little as they could the first seasons because they're like, he's not anybody.
I got paid a little bit more than John and Jenna because eventually we all made the same.
It was a bigger part.
Well, and I had done some pilots and I had been on 6 Feet Under.
Right. 6 Feet
so,
Under. As the intern.
Yes. And Arthur. And then that raised my status a little bit. So my agents were able to give me a little bit more. But I didn't make a ton of money those first seasons.
Was it extraordinary, though, being on that show? Especially in the first season where you just, was it so much excitement, so much, or was there pressure? Did you love going to set?
We loved it. I mean, it's such a boring story, but we fucking loved it. It was great.
Did you improvise all the time?
Here's the deal with improvisation. People ask us a lot. Listen, if the script is great, you don't need to improvise. You know, if Greg right. Daniels has written an amazing script, you can try and improvise. It's not going to be any funnier than what's on the page. You know what I mean? So we improvise sometimes. Yeah. And sometimes to help scenes and to bridge scenes and just for fun. And they really let us do that.
Who broke the most? Who laughed the most? Who could not handle it? Who did you find, honestly, the funniest? Who made you fucking go, oh my God, I can't.
I would say Brian Baumgartner, who played Kevin, broke the most. He would laugh at a, you know, you could just kind of like twitch your nostril at him and he would just start to break.
Did you hate it? Because it ruined a good take?
Yeah, but then he would also like blame it. Like I would like twitch my nostril at him and he would start to laugh and he'd go, Rain, he did it. He made me laugh.
And you're like, no, I didn't.
But John and I would always make each other laugh. Like there was something about when we would improvise, like, if one would start to go, the other would go, and we would just be useless. We would just be lost. But, you know, we were shooting. I remember this director came on set, and we were, like, hugging each other and high-fiving, joking around and watching YouTube videos and just having a great time. And then and this director was like, oh, my God. He goes, you have no idea. This is not how sets are. He goes, you are so spoiled. Nothing is better than this. You'll never have a job better than this. And it's true because it's an incredible camaraderie and love that was there.
And also, how many years?
9.
You know, and it's and I hate this because even when I did a show for 7 years, you're going from something that's so big, something that's so like universal, and people are like, well, what's next? What is he doing? How could you possibly beat the biggest TV show on earth, The Office? There's no way to go up. It's almost impossible for you to go any higher than The Office. Maybe you will. You're hilarious. You're talented. But it's like, if you have those expectations, like, oh, it's not as good as The Office. It's not as good as Smallville. It's not as good as The Office. You know, then you're just, I mean, that's, you need help.
It's tough. Yeah, it's really tough because right after The Office, I did this show Backstrom on Fox. I got canceled after 13 episodes and, you know, all of it's like, oh, that's it. Rainn Wilson sunk. You know, he tried his other TV show.
Were you heartbroken by that?
In some ways, I was. In some ways, I was kind of relieved. It was so hard. It was like...
Yeah, 1 hour.
Lead of a 1 hour show. I mean, you're
not
working
fun.
14, 15 hours a day and just working Friday nights till, you know, 5 a.m. and just, it was backbreaking, exhausting work.
Is that when the real therapy, the work you do with yourself with the meditation and stuff, you have to do that? Like, if you don't do that, are you fucked?
Yeah, you're really screwed, especially under that kind of stress. Yeah.
Were you, were your pressure. Stress levels really high?
Yeah, it was rough, but I was meditating then and, you know, doing what I could to stay grounded. Yeah.
Were they ever like, God, Rain looks really tired today?
Oh, yeah. I look tired every day. I was so beat.
It's like, do you worry about those things? Do you worry about how you're going to look on film? Do you worry about how you, like, because a lot of actors, like, you know, I think it's everybody. It's like, you want to look the best you can. You want them to like you a certain way.
I guess I've always been so weird looking that I've always, like, it's never really bothered me. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm schlubby, I'm overweight, or I look haggard or whatever. I don't have that much vanity around that.
That's probably a relief in a way that you just don't feel that way. Because there's a lot of people that are like, oh, is this good? Is this angle better on me? Where you don't think about that. You just do the work.
Yeah, I've worked with actors that's
does it bother you?
It bothers me a little bit, but I also just feel bad for them. Like, oh, wow, they're so connected to how they look and how they're perceived externally. Ugh.
Because the reality is this. If the show and all the crew and they're filming you and the director and the producers are right behind there, it's their job to make you look good. If you're worrying about it, they should be worrying about it. Hey, let's get a little, let's put a Kino. It's called a Kino over Rain.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
They can fix all that in post anyway.
Oh, you know?
So
can they?
But the other thing is, well, a little bit. The other thing is weird is like on social media, like I have a beard now and it's pretty gray and it's like, I'm 53. I look pretty fucking great for 53.
Yeah.
But like online, everyone's like, oh, he's old. Dwight's got old. Dwight's old. Old Dwight is old.
What the fuck's wrong with people?
Guys,
I'm 53.
I was shooting The Office in 2004. You know, like 15 years ago is when we started it.
I know.
It's like, I'm older than that.
Look what babies they were. They do that. I've read that where it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Look at Lex Luthor now. I'm like, I was 26 when I started the show. That was 20 years ago, and I look pretty goddamn good.
You do.
Well, you look great. You really look great. And fuck the grays. I'm getting grays in my beard.
Yeah.
I get grays. What are you going to do? Look, this is enough. This is more than enough for me. I feel like I could just talk to you forever because we don't really know each other. We met through James Gunn at a party, and you play tennis.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, I joined the Mulholland Tennis Club recently.
Okay.
So we should play tennis.
We absolutely should do that.
I would
Can
love
you play?
That.
You have a titanium spine.
You know what's funny is I haven't lost any mobility. And in about 2 months or a month and a half, I could start playing tennis. After I go away, I come back. I can pretty much play tennis. Yes, and
we got a text chain going now, so we're good.
Yeah.
No, this was a real pleasure too. Like, I'm a big fan of your podcast. I've always liked your acting a great deal. Met you through James Gunn, and I was like, oh, that's just an interesting, cool, offbeat guy, and I'm so glad that we're getting to know each other.
You didn't realize I was this troubled, did you?
I didn't know that you were as deeply troubled. No, I did not know that.
I was hoping you would have said,
neither did America.
Troubled.
Neither did America. See,
I was hoping you'd say, you're not that troubled, but you didn't. You went with that. Wow, I did not know.
Will you please do your podcast from rehab?
Hey, I'm with my psychiatrist.
Mia, will you go with him?
Yeah, I don't know if I really want to fly out
to the East Coast. Wait,
could you imagine? That actually would be really interesting. Day one,
yep.
This is Michael. Hey, so I'm here.
They would
met
be
with
like,
it.
You're such a narcissist. You need to put the microphone away.
Of course, that's the opposite of what you
opposite.
Want in there.
Yeah.
Thanks for allowing me to be inside of you.
Thanks for being deep inside of me.
Deep.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.